At the May 2023 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society, Patrick Kirkwood presented his reflections on family, church and media, 1935 to 2023. He's introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody.
Patrick Kirkwood joined the ABC in 1961 and worked for religious programs for most of that time and his resignation in 1985. He was head of the department for the last 7 years. And it was in that capacity that I actually got to know Patrick, mainly through a common friend, Nigel Butley, the composer who died last year. And I remember well getting a telephone call from Nigel saying that he'd been commissioned to write a piece, and that the first thing he did when John Hopkins said, "I'd like you to write this piece for the Pre-Italia," which he won, was to go down to Patrick Kirkwood's office and say, "Patrick, I've got this wonderful, terrible, daunting commission at the same time. What do you think it should be about?" And Patrick said, "I've just been reading the New English translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I think there's something in it for you. There's a description of a battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, and you can make something of that." And Nigel never forgot that. He didn't forget it when he came to see me a few months later to tell me that he'd won the Italia Prize and he needed injections and inoculations, as one did, of course, travelling in those days. And he said, "I don't know whether to trust you or not to spread this rumour around, because it's got to remain top secret." So I gave him the injections and I gave him my word. Anyway, Patrick goes on to say, he was then appointed as director of the Catholic Audiovisual Centre, reporting to the Sydney Catholic Education Office. He stayed in that position until 2002. In 1973, he was awarded the Archbishop of Sydney's Award for Media, and in 1996, the Dr. Percy Jones Award, quote, "in recognition of outstanding dedication and service given to music for worship," awarded by the Anglican and Catholic Archbishops of Melbourne. That reminds me, but in 2013, the Anglican Diocese of Melbourne's Historical Commission had a conference to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the arrival of Mannix in Melbourne. And in due course, he became the Archbishop. And some years later, the Anglicans appointed a Cambridge Don, Dr. Head, to be the Archbishop of Melbourne. He was initially fairly courteous to Daniel, but he always signed his name with a cross and Head Melbourne. Daniel always signed it Daniel Mannix. Some years later, we were told, a leading horse trainer in Melbourne wrote to Mannix and said, "Your Grace, I've just got a wonderful stallion. He's going to be a champion. I'd like to name him after you." And Mannix wrote back and said, "That's very kind of you, and I don't have any interest in horse racing myself. But as an Irishman, I realise that many of my flock have a great interest in the turf and the sport of kings. And so I realise what an honour it is for you to asked me to name the stallion after me." But he said, "I have to tell you in all frankness, I'd hate to read the headline that said, 'Mannix beaten by a head.'" Now, Patrick is talking to us today. It's really my life in 35, 40 minutes. And he says that he told me the other day that, like a good play, to give it some structure, he divided it into four acts. And he's going to, that's not the only literary allusion, because today's reference has a last line. It's funny, you know, I always remember for the opening lines of Kubla Khan, "In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree." You tend to forget the last words. And today's topic is an acknowledgement, obeisance in a way, to Kubla Khan. And he says, "Milk of Paradise, Reflections on Family, Church and Media, 1935 to 2023. I think we should all acknowledge what a great privilege it is to have Patrick here, to bring his wealth of experience, his basic integrity and his eloquence and his music and broadcasting experience here to speak to us today. Patrick, welcome.
Well, thanks very much, Jack, for your kind words and congratulations on your extension of your presidency for this distinguished society, and we know that it will go on to a strong and fruitful future. And I think the society has made a great contribution to the story of the Catholic Church in Australia and on the larger canvas over a long period. Jack is right when he said he twisted my arm. I've got here in my script he asked me on a few occasions in the past to consider giving a talk, and I'd always declined. But now I think this is probably the right time, especially in the view of the words of the Holy Father Pope Francis, what he's been saying recently. He's been dwelling on the importance of memory. Memory and hope, he said, go hand in hand. They complement each other. Each of us, he said, is invited to take a few moments to think back and remember the moments in which he or she met the Lord, to remember those who passed on their faith to us, and to brush up on the law. I don't like that bit. But anyway, in October, he said, recounting the events of our life enables us to grasp important nuances and details which can reveal themselves to be valuable aids hitherto concealed. He goes on, our life is the most precious book that is given to us, a book that unfortunately many do not read, or rather they do so too late before dying. So I thought I'd better get in quick. We are able, he said, to notice other things, making our life richer, more respectful of complexity, succeeding also in grasping the discrete ways in which God acts in our life. And so this is a venture in the genre of a book by the Australian historian Anna Clark, Private Lives and Public Histories. So that's basically what I'm on about. And so having worked for the media for many years of my life, I thought about what shape this talk should take. I thought maybe it's a documentary series, or maybe a gripping drama, or even a soap opera. But I thought simplicity is the key, so I've made it a play in four acts. Act one, childhood. Act two, 25 years at the ABC. Act three, 15 years in the Catholic education system. And act four, now and always, and what next? It might seem wrong to define one's occupations by... define one's life by occupations, but it's quite a common thing. You know, when we meet a new person or hear about somebody, they say, oh, what does he or she do? But I must add to my four acts the fact of being underpinned at all times by family. And by family, I mean where I have come from in family, and my wonderful brothers and sisters, and my beautiful wife Mary, and our six children. They have defined my life in so many ways. My life has also been underpinned by the church, and by that I mean not just the Catholic Church, but the whole body of Christ. I was born on the 21st of March 1935 in Beamish Street, Campsie, in the parish of St. Mel's. And there's another parish down in Narandra called St. Mel's, and I'll mention that later on. My mother was Catherine Agnes Higgins, and my father, Victor Shaw Kirkwood. The Higgins family came from Ireland in 1841 on the ship Albatross, initially living in the Hunter Valley. But my grandparents, Ellen and Patrick, moved to Sydney, and she had a boarding house at Kirribilli. And they continued to raise some of their 13 children there. My father, Victor, had come to Australia in July 1908 on the ship Thomas from Durban, South Africa. He had spent 5 or 6 years in South Africa in the diamond mines as a tally clerk and in the wool trade. On his shipping papers, he was listed as an auctioneer. His work in Australia was entirely in the wool trade. He had originally come from Belfast at the age of 18, and he was a Presbyterian. As Providence would have it, he became a boarder with my grandmother Ellen at Kirribilli. Her family had been Salvation Army further back. Later in life, people said to him that he became a Catholic to marry the daughter Catherine, but he said, oh no, it was her mother that brought me into the Catholic Church. And if you check the records, he did join the Catholic Church 4 years before he married Kit, as she was called. Now, I'm the youngest of six children, the eldest being Joseph, the next one Ursula, then a brother Reginald, and another brother John, and some of his progeny are here today, and a sister Maureen. Now, I've got a photograph of the eight of us in the lounge room of the house where I was born. There we all are lined up, and I think that the picture was taken probably at the end of 1938, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So, as we gather here today, I'm the sole survivor of that group, unfortunately, although we did go on to produce 32 grandchildren. Unfortunately, my father did not get to meet any of them since he died of a sudden heart attack in 1945. The reason that the photograph was probably taken in 1938 is because my eldest brother Joseph was a brilliant student at school, and he won an exhibition to go to Sydney University to study law. And he did this for about 2 years, and then he decided to join the Order of the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart and to study for the priesthood. One of the prerequisites of that was to spend a year in the school at St Mary's Towers at Douglas Park, and he began that year in 1938. And so I suspect that's why the photo was taken. It was a shot of all of us together before he went away. He would have done his novitiate in 1939, which meant we wouldn't see much of him at all. And I suspect that's why the photograph was taken. And so off he went to Melbourne in 1940 to study philosophy and theology. Now, we would have visited him at Douglas Park on a few occasions. I don't know whether you've ever been there. The property is called St Mary's Towers. It was originally built by the Surveyor General Sir Thomas Mitchell. Sir Thomas Mitchell and the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart bought the property in 1904, and they've been there ever since. And in later years, it's been used as a retreat centre. Now, we would have visited my brother Joe there many times, so I got to know the place quite well, and my first-hand child impression of the place was a place of welcome and friendship. And, of course, all this happened under the shadow of the start of World War II, 1939. Not long after Joe had left home in 1939, my parents decided to sell up their house in Campsie, and they chose Randwick as a place to go to because it was staffed by the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart, and that would give them a closer connection with their eldest son's life. Our house in Randwick was right opposite the main gates of the Little Sisters of the Poor home for the aged, and their chapel was used for North Randwick parishioners for Mass on Sundays, and I eventually became an altar boy there. And when the priest said, Intro ibo ad altare Dei, I would say, Adam qui letificat juventudem meam. Everybody knew that. But I had no idea what I was saying. And nor did some people in the congregation, I imagine. I was about 9 years old. Now, I'd been at St Anthony's Clovelly from 1942 and then at Morris Brothers College at Randwick, later Marcellin College, for classes 3 to 6. And my father died suddenly while I was in fourth class, and I can remember the teacher telling me to go home, Pat, there's something wrong at home, you better go home. And this was a great time of stress after my dad died, and to add to the grief, my brother Reg, who was on his way home from service in the RAAF in England, had heard of his father's passing when the ship docked in Fremantle, and his name was called out, and they told him. And then to add to it all, my brother Joseph in the seminary became very ill in Melbourne. Luckily, we'd been able to see him a few times in spite of wartime restrictions on travel, but he had bone cancer. And the MSC order brought him back to Douglas Park because the food and the climate there were much better. But he did not improve, and he died in 1947, the year that his class was ordained. It's worth repeating here the words of Pope Francis, which I quoted earlier. Recounting the events of our life enables us to grasp important nuances and details which can reveal themselves to be valuable aids hitherto concealed. I was 12 years old at that time, a quiet, philosophic young boy. I was attached to the practices of the church. I was quite comfortable in its ways. And I had been influenced by the nuns at the Little Sisters of the Poor across the road. They had a huge property, and I used to go over there and wander around and go into the house and talk to all the old folk. And I was happy to do so. And so it was suggested to me that I might like to go to school at the junior at Douglas Park, and I was quite happy to do so. And so I went there beginning in 1948 to begin my secondary education. I had won a New South Wales state bursary in 1947, so that was a help financially. Well, there's really no room here to sing the praises of the community and the life at St Mary's Towers. I was very happy there. I learned English, Latin, Greek, French, history, mathematics, physics, chemistry, and of course religion, and a good dose of liturgy and music. And we were blessed with some very fine teachers at the school. The standout was probably Father Tim Kelly, who was a Cambridge graduate of the Levis School, but he wasn't a fanatic, and he taught English and Greek. And later on, there was a book published called The Focal Word. It's a masterpiece of writing about English literature and poetry. And I was very lucky to have him as a teacher. And when he passed away, there was an obituary of him in the Sydney Morning Herald entitled A Lifetime in Love with Shakespeare. He was an extraordinary teacher. I can still remember his Greek. The other features of life at Douglas Park were a 1,000-acre property with hikes and picnics and working on the farm and eating its bountiful produce. And in many ways, it was idyllic. And so I finished the leaving certificate, had a holiday, and then I returned to the park, as it was called, in 1953 to the novitiate, which was a year of intense formation, discernment and commitment. And then I proceeded to the monastery at Croydon, where my brother had been, to study philosophy and theology. And by this time, my mother had downsized to a new dwelling and my siblings had married and started their families. Dr. Paul Collins, whom many of you will know, was also a member of the Missionaries of the Sacred Heart for a time, and he's had extensive academic experience all around the world. And he said to me once in recent years that he thought the faculty at Croydon Seminary at that time was by far the best in Australia. There were certainly some outstanding teachers. There was a Father John Savage who taught me philosophy. He was very open-minded and he sometimes brought in visiting lecturers such as Max Charlesworth, who had recently come back to Australia and he was very conversant with contemporary English and French philosophy. John Savage also introduced to us the articles by Bernard Lonergan, whose thoughts and principles have dominated my life ever since, as many of my friends will know. Father Cuscally taught dogmatic theology, and he was fresh from the Gregorian University in Rome and an ardent follower of Henri de Lubac, Jean Danielou, Yves Congar, and other figures in the Nouvelle Théologie movement of the mid-20th century called Ressourcement. They went back to the sources. He later went on to be the Superior General of the Order in Rome and still later an auxiliary bishop in Brisbane, and he taught dogmatic or systematic theology. And then there was Father Dennis Murphy. He was newly arrived back from the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome and the École Biblique in Jerusalem. Now, Dennis was the most inspiring teacher I have ever had in any subject. But, of course, he had the advantage of teaching scripture, which is inspiring. In recent years down at the Catholic University in Strathfield, I happened to meet the Salesian biblical scholar, Father Frank Maloney. Now, Frank is one of the best scripture scholars in the world at the moment, and I happened to say to him that I'd studied scripture with Dennis Murphy, and he said, "Ah, the father of modern biblical studies in Australia." And so Vatican II was no surprise for me. Rather, it was a confirmation of everything which I had learnt at Croydon in the 1950s. As well as studies there, I was the choir master for a time and an assistant librarian, and I started a house magazine called Theologian, which was later morphed into the widely read magazine Compass. But the exciting intellectual life was not the main game. To repeat what the Pope has said, we begin to notice other things, making our life richer, more respectful of complexity, succeeding also in grasping the discrete ways in which God acts in our life. So as I matured, I began to question what was called my vocation. And Father Jim Cuscully was my saviour. As well as teaching theology, he was, more importantly, director of studies. And the previous director had been a man who quoted the gospel, "No one who puts his hand to the plough and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God." So his motto was, "Don't look back." But Father Cuscully was trained in psychology, a more subtle character and a good listener. And together we tried to discern what was my true life's path. Eventually it became clearer to me that I was not in the right place, and the provincial of the order came down from Sydney for a talk. They didn't want to particularly lose me, and he suggested that I might teach for a year in one of their colleges and get out and meet people and change my perspective. And so I did. I went in 1960 to Monavay College in Hamilton in Western Victoria and taught a variety of subjects, and I must say it's the hardest I have ever worked in one year before or since. It was non-stop boarding school stuff. But at the end of it all, it was even clearer to me that my life with the MSCs and the prospect of ordination was not for me. So I was fitted out with a new suit and given a little bit of money and returned on the train to Sydney, where I was welcomed by my mother and my family members into a new phase of life. End of Act 1. Act 2, 25 years with the ABC. Now, you might be wondering why the whole of Act 1 was called childhood. In the play of life, childhood ends when one becomes truly responsible and independent, and that happened to me at the age of 25. It's worth noting here a book called Mystical Journey by William Johnston, who lived most of his priestly life in Japan, and he was an expert in Eastern mysticism. Very good book if you want to read up about Zen, because he lived most of his life in Japan. He says this, quote, "The true self is at first undiscovered or dormant. It comes to birth only as one grows up. In my case," he says, "the influence of my mother was very great. She wanted me to be celibate. She wanted me to be a Jesuit. She wanted me to be a writer. In short, she wanted me to do all the things that she could not do because she was a woman. I can well understand the priests who wake up at the age of 40 and realize that their vocation was their mother's, coming from the ego that was formed in early childhood, and then they felt obliged to ask if their true vocation was to jettison celibacy and marry." But he goes on talking of himself. He says, "The influence of my mother was very great, but the root of my vocation went much deeper than that." But with me, I was back home in Randwick, and my second sister Maureen and her husband by that time had got into the tertiary level of education. And they said, "Oh, well, you know, you might like to keep on in the education field." But I said something quite surprising to them. I said, "No, I want to join the ABC." And they, "Well, where did that come from?" Well, I'd been listening to their programs over the years, and I thought, I could do that. And so I set my heart on it. Luckily, my sister had a school friend who had married Bernie Kerr, the head of ABC Sport. And so I made an appointment to go and see him. And his welcoming advice was brief and to the point. He said, "Good on you, Pat," in his sporting voice. He said, "Quite often they advertise jobs inside the ABC and not in the press. So what you need to do is get a job in the ABC, doing whatever you can, licking stamps, delivering furniture, anything." I said, "Okay." And so he set me up an appointment at the personnel department. And I went to see the little man sitting at the desk, and he had a box of cards on the desk, and he flicked through it. And he said, "Did you say that you had library experience?" And I said, "Yes, I was the assistant librarian at the college." "Oh," he said, "there's a job going in the film library at Gore Hill Studios." I said, "That's good, I'll take it." And that was the start of 25 years in the ABC. Television in Australia at that time was 4 years old. It was transmitted at that stage just in the capital cities and Canberra. There were no coaxial cables, no microwave dishes, no satellites, so all the programs had to be sent by air to the respective cities. This included films of movies, overseas programs, but more importantly, recordings of local programs, most of which originated in Sydney and Melbourne. Videotape didn't exist at that time, so all the programs were recorded and processed on film. About halfway through my 6 months at Gore Hill, I was promoted to telerecording clerk. I had to make sure that all the programs were recorded properly and copied to be sent to the respective cities. I learned a lot in those 6 months in terms of how television works, in terms of staffing and planning and technology. And I was free to wander around the studios. I used to do a lot of weekend work and, you know, wander into the control room, and they'd say, "Oh, hello, Pat, hello, Pat." go and watch 6 o'clock rock being recorded. And I got to know many people. It was quite providential. In the middle of that year, two vacancies came up in the religious department, one in Sydney and one in Melbourne. I applied for both of them, and I got the Melbourne one, much to my mother's disappointment. Now, the religious department in Melbourne at that time was part of the talks department, and it was situated in an old house in William Street near the studios. The staff consisted of two ordained Anglican clergy, an assistant producer and a secretary. And I was taking up the role of assistant producer, which had temporarily been occupied by a very nice lady called Gillian Waite, who very kindly showed me the studios and what was needed to do a recording and how to bring people in, all that kind of practical advice. This was my first experience of working with women, and I think they found me rather intriguing. And that was when I remembered the lines from Kubla Khan by Coleridge: "Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread, for he on honeydew hath fed and drunk the milk of paradise." There was a certain remoteness about me, I think. I'd been living an isolated life in many ways, but we gradually got to know one another very well. I was the first Catholic to join the department after Richard Connolly, and by that time Richard had moved on into education. One evening after work, we were sitting there having a drink, and we used to talk about all kinds of things, including our beliefs. About an hour or so later, we ended up agreeing that we all believed exactly the same thing about the Eucharist. That's very interesting, an early experience of practical ecumenism. Now, on radio at that time, they had about 30 separate slots in the schedules each week. Now, that took a lot of work but it was a guaranteed output, which was shared between Sydney and Melbourne and later with the other capital cities. One of the famous programs was community hymn singing, and that was the second most popular program on the ABC after Blue Hills, which, of course, is well remembered. Blue Hills is the most popular. Community hymn singing was number two. How the world has changed. At the seminary, our studies about the church, ecclesiology, relied largely on a book which Jim Koskelly used. It was put out by the World Council of Churches, in which each member church described its belief about the church. Now, that was very enlightening to us kind of, you know, half-blind Catholics. And now, as I met many people from other Christian denominations into my work, I began to get a very concrete appreciation of the body of Christ in all its human variations. I worked happily in Melbourne for about 2 years, and then I was promoted to a higher position in Sydney. Over time, I gradually assumed the position of executive producer of television programs. But before that, I'd produced many radio programs, including 15 years scripting and presenting sacred music, visiting many churches for services transmitted on radio and television, producing documentaries. I did the commentary on television for the first papal visit, Paul VI, with Martin Royal. I also initiated a program featuring the Reverend Roger Bush, who was quite famous. He was a character, and when he went into commercial media, I presented a replacement program called Saturday Saints with my co-producer, Ross Saunders. I could tell you about where the title came from, but I might tell you that in question time. The biggest development in television happened when the Whitlam government came to power. The ABC's budget at that time was considerably improved. Our television budget went up by 700%. Perhaps the powers that be in television land had realised that we were trying to do adventurous things. Well, that was a lot of money to take care of. So I said to my boss, "Can I spend some of this money on research?" And he said, "Yes." So I rang Hugh McKay, who's an old friend of mine, because he'd started his career in the ABC, and I asked him to do research what program formats and religious ideas would be likely to be successful. The research came back saying that what I was thinking was largely attractive and workable. Now, interestingly enough, other departments in the ABC, including Four Corners, heard about this, and they all want copies of this research because it described the way that people relate to television and how they react to new ideas. When I eventually became the director of the department, I'm leaving a lot out here, I had on my office wall a plaque which said, "Comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable." So that was my motto. I set up several staff development sessions and I asked a management expert from Melbourne to come to lead the sessions. His name was John Little. He was actually a relative of the Archbishop. And I chose him because of his appreciation of religion and also because he was a fan of Bernard Lonergan's philosophy of communication. He was a well-known management expert. He completely redesigned all his management training courses using Lonergan's philosophy. It's quite extraordinary. My television staff in this meeting that we had agreed that we would work on a 5-year plan to get programs into prime time. Now, that might sound a long lead time, but television does take a lot of effort to gather together research staff and do scripting and do sites, all that stuff. It goes on. But we actually did it in 3 years. And the program that we got into prime time was called Healers, Quacks or Mystics, which was an exploration of healing through spiritual means. We also did an influential series called The Sunburnt Soul on Australian spirituality, and quite a number of interviews under the heading of Man in Question and Woman in Question. These programs were about well-known figures in public life, and they explored what made them tick, generally, or always really, filming them in their place of work. The current chair of the ABC, Ida Buttrose, was one of the interviewees at the time. Our work in radio has been largely told in detail by Alison Healy in her PhD thesis and in a talk which she gave to this society some years ago. And that is available, I would think, on your website. In the thesis, she referred to me as a reluctant bureaucrat and a diffident director. I have no argument with being a reluctant bureaucrat. But I think the epithet of diffident director was partly true within the bounds of radio. But when I look back at it all now, I realise that most of my energy when I was the director went into television. Radio kind of looked after itself. There were guaranteed slots that you filled and a fairly guaranteed kind of budget, and so you worked to produce material for those slots. But television was a different game. One had to fight first to get the resources to make programs, and then you would get the slots depending on the excellence of what you produced. But in radio, I did initiate a significant new popular program teaching the art of meditation with an English Jesuit called Bill Hewitt. And in later history, ABC salespeople told me it was one of the best-selling cassettes they'd ever produced. I've got 5 letters of reference about my time as director in the religious department in television, and I'll explain their origin a bit later. But all those letters acknowledge our struggle and achievement to make innovative television programs about religion in a changing world. But I'll take a break here to tell a specific story in relation to the history of the Catholic Church, and it's a story which I don't think has ever been told anywhere else. We decided to make a documentary about Monsignor Patrick Hartigan, well known as John O'Brien, the poet, and his collection of poems around the Boree log. Now, I've discussed this with Jack before. From 1917 until 1944, Hartigan was the pastor of St. Mel's Parish in Narandra, and his reputation down there was very high. He had ministered to many people in the flu outbreak after World War I, regardless of his own safety, and thank God he didn't catch the flu, and it didn't matter whether people believed or not, he ministered to everybody. And we spoke to many people down there in Narandra who knew him, including his former housekeeper. We were intrigued that she seemed quite sad about his departure from Narandra. But the same sadness seemed to go deeper than just the fact that he had retired. This impression was reinforced by a few people, and eventually somebody said, "Oh, why don't you go and talk to old Mr. Gamage?" He had been the editor of the local paper. And by the way, his son, Bill Gamage, is a very well-known Australian historian. And so we went to his house in one of the back streets of Narandra and knocked on the door. And this little man came to the front door, and he was holding this thing about like a small mobile phone and a piece of wire going into his ear. And he held it out for us to talk into. So we told him who we were, and he invited us inside and sat down at the table. And it was really an extraordinary conversation, because he was talking, holding out his hearing aid for us to talk into, and then he would talk into it himself so we could hear himself. It was really, really quite strange. So we told him what we had been researching, and we mentioned that we'd heard that Monsignor Hartigan had left, and people seemed to be very sad about it. But it was a strange kind of sadness. And he said, "Oh, don't you know that story? Well, the antennas went up." What had happened was that the bishop wanted Father Hartigan to have a curate. And so he would send the curate, and then Hartigan didn't want one, and he didn't like that one, so he would send him back. And so many came and many went back. I've got another story about one of the curates I can tell you later if you ask me. And so the curates came and went, but eventually one came whom Hartigan liked. They got on well, old Mr. Gammage said. They were like father and son. It was lovely. But then one day the curate came to Father Hartigan and said that he had fallen in love with one of the ladies in the parish and he was going to leave the priesthood to marry her. Well, in those days, that was quite a scandal. So Hartigan arranged a send-off for this young curate, and the story was put out that he was going to work in another parish in Victoria, and everybody said farewell. But you can bet your bottom dollar that Hartigan would have gone to the editor of the local paper and asked him to keep a lid on the story. I did some research before we actually filmed that documentary, and I discovered that the curate had died, but his wife and children were still alive in Victoria. So we didn't include the story in the program. And as far as I know, it's never been told anywhere else. And so it was at the age of 66, not too old, Father Patrick Joseph Hartigan retired to the Convent of the Sacred Heart at Rose Bay with a broken heart. I once asked an American public relations priest that was visiting Sydney from Los Angeles, what was his main principle? He said, "Tell the truth with charity." Eventually, the ABC became a corporation instead of a commission with a new board under the direction of Ken Meyer and Wendy McCarthy, and they began to make all new appointments and arrangements. The new general manager, or managing director, as he was called, was appointed, and he only lasted a couple of years. But there was a revolution going on with lots of new ideas being touted. Most senior positions were renamed and re-advertised. The controller of television, Jim Fitzmaurice, was replaced by a new person, and in my mind that was an utter disaster. Jim Fitzmaurice was one of the best managers I ever worked with. We had disagreements, but they were always forgotten. And when he was announcing that he was leaving the ABC, I was the first one to speak up and speak with regret. He went on to become manager of PBL, Publishing and Broadcasting Limited, which is Packer's empire. They snapped him up. So the ABC management was stupid. As the charges went on, I became more disillusioned with the new management, and I remember writing to my former boss, who had retired. I said, perhaps I could sit around and wait for the phoenix to arise from the ashes, but I don't think I will. And so I actually drew up a flow chart of possible scenarios, and to trigger it off, I applied for redundancy, because lots of jobs were becoming redundant. After a month or so, I got a telephone call saying, no, we don't consider the position of head of religion to be redundant. I said, thank you very much. Could you put that on paper, please? So they sent me a memorandum saying that the head of religion was not to be redundant. I photocopied it and sent it to all my staff around Australia, and then I resigned. At least I got the guarantee. I was 50 years old, and it was now or never. And so we come to Act 3, 15 years in the Catholic education system. I had already put out feelers to various organisations about possible employment. This is before I resigned, of course. And one day I got a phone call from Brother Walter Simmons, who was head of the Catholic Education Office at Leichhardt. So I went there and I parked my car in the office, and somebody was getting out of the car next to me, and it was Father John O'Donnell, who was the director of the Catholic Audiovisual Centre at Homebush. I knew about the place because I had been invited previously to be on the board, which was keeping an eye on this outfit. Actually, there were more people on the board than there were staff at the centre. I said to John, "Oh, I'm going in to see Brother Simmons." And he said, "Oh, so am I." And the penny started to drop as we went in. Brother Simmons said to me, "John O'Donnell is leaving his position at Homebush. Would you like to take it on?" Well, that was quite a surprise. And so I said I would think about it. And so after a couple of phone calls and meetings about fine details, I accepted the position. Now, having been on the board, which oversaw the centre, I had a pretty good idea of what they did. But luckily, I was also interested in what I call group media, as opposed to mass media. Group media are obviously aimed at groups, and not to many people. And many educational outfits were using this concept. The media that you produce are not meant for television or radio, but they're to be used in groups in educational contexts. They tend to provide information and pose questions, but they don't give answers. The answers are supposed to come from the group. And so I began my 15 years under the wing of the Catholic Education Office. Someone said to me that I must be happy to be leaving the ABC bureaucracy, and I said I was going to work for the mother of all bureaucracies. As I did in the ABC, I asked John Little, the management consultant, to come up from Melbourne to give us a feel for how we might develop. So he ran about a week's training course with the staff. I remember that one of the men on the staff described his current state of mind as being like a beached whale. Anyway, it was a successful staff gathering, and we got a feel for how we might develop. And as the years went on, we won a number of prizes for some of our videos. It was a very good team, and we had very good facilities. The centre was financed by income from sales to the tune of about 60%, and the remaining 40% came as a subsidy from the Catholic Education Office. Around about the time I took up my position there, Brother Kelvin Canavan took over the directorship, and he had returned from overseas with qualifications in business administration. And his reorganising of the Catholic Education Office was outstanding. And I had many good meetings with him about the Catholic Audiovisual Centre, as it was called, CAVC, and its future. The big problem came when Sydney split into three dioceses, Broken Bay and Parramatta and Sydney. And to cut a long story short, neither of the other two dioceses kept supporting CAVC in the long term. So I drafted a letter which went to every diocese in Australia saying that if they put in 65 cents per student per year based on their school populations, we could keep going. Many of the small country dioceses said yes because they knew the value they were getting, but the large dioceses, particularly Brisbane and Melbourne, did not agree. And so regretfully, the operations of the centre were wound up. We did continue to make fewer video programs using outside resources, and we moved from Homebush to Leichhardt. There I became much more involved in print publication, public relations for the system and for the schools, and for the creation of their website. In 1988, while I was still at Homebush, the National Bishops' Conference advertised a job called National Executive Officer, Communications for the Australian Catholic Bishops Committee for Social Communications. Quite a mouthful. Kind of bureaucratic, I thought. I thought I would apply for the job, and so I obtained five letters of reference from some four former colleagues. They're the letters I referred to earlier. The former colleagues were Jim Fitzmaurice, who had been the head of television at ABC, and he was now the managing director of Packer's Media Group. There was Paddy Conroy, who by then was head of television for SBS. There was Jan Land, who had been the director of planning for the ABC for ABC Television, and unfortunately she just passed away a few weeks ago. And there was a letter from Hugh McKay, who knew my work quite well. And finally, one from my very first supervisor in Melbourne, the Reverend Geoffrey Ward, who went on to be head of Radio Australia in the ABC and then moved back into the church as a communications officer. So my application went in with these fine letters of recommendation. And the person arranging the applications for the vacancy was none other than my old mate from Melbourne, John Little, the management consultant. He did a lot of work for the in-church circles. Time went by, and eventually I got a phone call from John Little saying, "Oh, hello, Patrick. Oh, the bishops have withdrawn that job." I said, "Oh. Well, if you heard or read Father Brian Lucas's talk to this group some time ago, he gave to this society in 2015, which is a very interesting talk, you will see that there was a lot of internal dissent amongst the bishops and various groups in the bishops' conference, particularly about dealing with the media. They eventually appointed a lady called Mary Newport as National Communications Officer, and that job was said to be morphed from the original advertised position. Now, Brian Lucas rather wryly says in his talk and in his article that all the people that have held that job since that time have been women. And I doubt whether he is implying any sense of women's empowerment. I mention this because of the ongoing tensions between the churches and the media. Brian Lucas's talk was entitled Missed Opportunities. So I retired from the Catholic Education Office in 2002. Act 4. Since retirement. Now, this now is quite long. I retired in 2002. That was 20 years ago. Now, this now is a moving target, and perhaps I should go back through Acts 1 and 2 and 3 and add some detail about other interests and activities which have always been related to church, and they are ongoing. Mary and I were married in 1967, and we have 6 wonderful children who have all gone on to follow their interests and have fulfilling lives. My life with her, of course, has been the strong foundation for everything that I've done. Mary and I met through music. We were both singers in the St. Gregory Chorale, which was founded and conducted by Dr. David Brannigan. And also we later sang in the big group called the Singers of David with the redoubtable Sister Gabriel Healy of the SGS sisters and the conductor, Colin Smith. Thanks very much. Yeah, Brother Colin Smith. And we travelled all around Australia giving demonstrations of good liturgical music. When I came home from Sydney from the seminary life in Melbourne, my old friend Stephen Peagham introduced me to the music scene in Sydney, and I joined the St. Gregory Chorale with David Brannigan. I also joined a group called the Guild of St. Pius X, in which David Brannigan was also involved. They were a group of people who were enthusiastic about the liturgy and its music, and we worked to find the best resources for like-minded people. Even before Vatican II, the Guild was very influential in promoting good liturgy and sacred music. When the Mass was made available in English, we organised many sessions of training for cantors and lectors at St Mary's Cathedral in cooperation with Father Ron Harden, who was very closely associated with the Guild. Father John DeLuca has written a thesis on the liturgy of the Archdiocese of Sydney, and again he says, "Opportunities missed." He praises the work of the Guild and says that the Guild was a victim of its own success. At its best, it reached into every part of Australia and it provided courses, seminars and resources, and also through its magazine, Hosanna. But as time went on, similar departments were set up in each diocese and the Guild really outlived its usefulness. But it certainly left a permanent mark on the Catholic Church in Australia. I was also a member of the Liturgy Commission in the Archdiocese of Sydney and a music consultant to the National Liturgical Commission in Canberra. In the 1970s, while I was still in the ABC, with my interest in church music, I was excited to hear that the Uniting Church was being formed from the Methodist, Presbyterian and Congregational churches, and they were planning to produce a new hymn book. The Anglican Church was also interested and had joined in the venture. I had a great friend at St Andrew's Cathedral in the city, the Reverend Lawrence Bartlett. He was the precentor there at the cathedral. And one day I was talking to him and I said, "I wonder if it would be possible for the Catholic Church to join in this venture of a new hymn book." He was quite stunned by that idea, saying, "Oh, surely the Catholic Church is so monolithic it would be difficult to achieve." I said, "Laurie, all we need is the imprimatur of one bishop. and I could get one. So I went to see Cardinal Freeman, who I knew reasonably well, and I told him about this, and in his usual brevity he said, "Go for it, Pat." And so the essential paperwork was done, and I was appointed with Father John Walsh to be on the editorial committee of the Australian Hymn Book. My main motive in doing this was to get access for Catholic people to this new book's treasury of hymnody. But it was also an opportunity for the editors of the book to include music by Richard Connolly and James Macaulay and other Catholic composers, and also the Gelinau Psalms. And so there was quite a deal of Catholic source music that went into it. Now, along the way, I was also choirmaster at Normanhurst Parish, where we lived for about 30 years, and we managed to enhance the liturgy through active participation, as Vatican II had recommended. My other main interest in recent years has been in the parish of Wurrunga. I was on the parish council, and 6 or 7 years ago, we put out a survey. Some people said that they would like something to read during the week. Well, at that time, we were putting out a mass sheet, which was blank. It was blank on the other side because they had a separate parish paper. So I said to Father David Ranson, the parish priest, "Look, I could fill that in for you every week if you like." So now that goes out every week, and I've done over 300 copies, 300 editions. But it's a great thing that people have had interesting material to read in between their visits to the church. I'm also a great believer in groups for what might be called adult faith formation. Around about the same time I was on the parish council, we set up a group called Come As You Are, and it's still going very well. I also arranged ecumenical gatherings and occasional talks. Hugh McKay came a few times, Paul Collins, John Cleary from the ABC. Most things I've done have been to do with communication, especially communication between the church and the world. Now, there's another angle to this relationship which is not often adverted to, and that the question is, what are the media doing to us and to the church? And in my travels, I've come across some very interesting books. One is The Electronic Gospel by William Koons, an American writer. Another one called The Play Theory of Mass Communication. And two by a lady called Gregor Goethals. One's called The TV Ritual, Worship at the Video Altar. And another one by her called The Electronic Golden Calf, Images, Religion, and the Making of Meaning. The underlying theme of all these books is that we human beings need a sense of play and entertainment and ritual and symbols which convey meaning. Bernard Lonergan says that we live in a world mediated by meaning. Their concern in these books is that these needs used to be met by activities such as church ritual, but now they're being satisfied by the rituals of radio and television and the internet. And so there's an underlying, almost unconscious dissatisfaction with what goes on in church. When they talk about ritual in the media, I mean, you all know the tune, etc. That's the opening hymn. And then the leader comes on and tells you the truth and the news, and it's all ritualized. And there was a famous newscaster in America called Ed Murrow, and at the end of his telecast, he always said, "Good night and good luck." So that was the final blessing. And when you look into it, it's quite an intriguing thesis. I've mentioned the name of Bernard Lonergan a few times. His best-known books are Insight, A Study of Human Understanding, and Method in Theology. He has described the method our intellect and our feelings work, and he's applied this method to the study of theology. But his method is equally applicable to other human activities, especially in a world of specializations where cooperation and sharing are crucial. The Second Vatican Council came to its conclusion in December 1965, and in the middle of that year, Lonergan gave a lecture on the idea of meaning as a crucial dimension of our lives. What would our lives be if they were meaningless? Where do we get our meaning from? We get it from the culture we live in and from the religion we practice. He defines theology as a bridge between religion and culture. We get meaning from our families, from our friends. Lonergan spells out the fact that the old classical culture has gone and it's been replaced by modern scientific culture. He often quoted an English historian called Herbert Butterfield, who says that the scientific revolution from the end of the 17th century outshines everything that has taken place since Christianity started, including the Renaissance and the Reformation, that they were mere episodes. That this scientific revolution has displaced the old classical culture. And so Lonergan spells out that fact that the classical culture has gone. The Pope said recently, Pope Francis, we are not living in an era of change, but a change of era. And this is precisely what Lonergan was saying in that lecture back in 1965, before the end of Vatican II. And I quote what he said. Classical culture cannot be jettisoned without being replaced. And what replaces it will run counter to classical expectations. There is bound to be formed a solid right that is determined to live in a world that no longer exists. I'll say that again. There is bound to be formed a solid right that is determined to live in a world that no longer exists. There is bound to be formed a scattered left, captivated by now this, now that new development, exploring this and this new possibility. But what will count is a perhaps not numerous centre, big enough to be at home in both the old and the new, painstaking enough to work out one by one the transitions to be made, strong enough to refuse half measures and insist on complete solutions, even though it has to wait. I put it to you that this is very much what Pope Francis is trying to do with synodality. He is trying to get us to pray and stop and think carefully, to move into the centre group, which will do what Lonergan calls the Herculean labours in revivifying the message of the gospel, which we now have to pass on to the new world in which we live. Jesus said, no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins and be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And this is a long, ongoing task. So let us aim to share the new wine, the honeydew of faith, and together to drink the milk of paradise. Thank you. Good. Thanks, Jay.
Well, thank you, Patrick. That was a classic example of what I said last month, that Patrick is a giant in Australian media. More than that, he is a most humble man, and he's passed over lots of things which he almost pleaded with us to ask him to elaborate on, stories that he didn't tell. But I'm sure that in addition to that, everyone has lots of questions. In particular, I want to discuss with him a book that I've just seen reviewed in two publications, the Times Literary Supplement and the Tablet, called Magisteria, The Entwined Histories of Science and Religion. It won't be released in Australia for a couple of months yet. No, the publishers at Penguin Random House don't think it's important enough. To judge from the book reviews that I've read, it's of vital importance, and I'm desperate to get my hands on it. So, Patrick, you may sit down, but there are a lot of people with a lot of questions, I think.
Thank you very much. Very simple question. Do you feel optimistic or pessimistic about the media landscape, particularly regarding religion today?
The media. The ABC did an encounter program to commemorate the 80th year of its existence. That was a few years ago. And David Rutledge was the producer, and he invited me and quite a few other people to participate in this program. And he gave me the honour of having the final say right at the end of the program. I can't remember the exact words, but I said something like that the churches, or religion in general, and the churches in particular, have a very edgy relationship to the media, and the media have been not good at coping with religious topics. And my final sentence was, and the thing is that they are both two of the most powerful influences in society. And I've seen this happen time and time again, that it was Brian Lucas said in his talk, he called it Missed Opportunities, and if you read his text carefully, it just went on and on, kind of arguing about what should be done. They commissioned a Jesuit priest, Father Paul Duffy, to do a comprehensive study of the church's relationship with the media, and it was a brilliant document, very well researched and argued. I mean, I had a fair bit of input into it. He talked to me quite extensively. It sank like a stone. It was quite unfortunate because he made some very creative recommendations. As far as the ABC is concerned, the treatment of religion has declined, in just the amount of it. And they've just announced the other day that the ABC is now in two departments, two divisions. One is news and current affairs, and the other one is content. They've got one person looking after content, and that person will decide what content is to be used. Now, it's going to be a very complex arrangement because, and what has caused it really is the advent of the internet and streaming and all that kind of stuff. You know, in the old days you had radio, you had television, you had print, and that was about it. But with the internet, the whole game has changed. And I think most broadcasting people around the world have discovered that an increasing number of people are now taking their content from the internet, streaming, podcasts, etc., etc. And I would... some people are predicting that radio and television as we know it will gradually disappear. What you will get out of your screen, which used to be a TV set, will be stuff that you get from cable, and you will choose when to watch it. It won't be on at a particular time. So the landscape is vastly different from what it was even 10 years ago. And I do feel a bit pessimistic about the coverage of religion, yes. Because the other thing that's happening in the ABC is they are not having specialists in a particular subject. I mean, you've still got Robin Williams still doing the science show. What will happen when he goes? I don't know. I mean, there's no kind of... I mean, we used to have the policy of recruiting people that were knowledgeable in different areas. But...
Patrick, along those lines, do you think that all this stuff that does come off the internet... Is there going to be some kind of replacement for the editor and editorial committees who can vet this information?
Yes.
Because there's so much misinformation.
Yes.
On the internet and.
Yeah. As far as the ABC is concerned, I know that within their current structure, they are now putting out a huge amount of material, and if you look at the department, which is called Religion and Ethics, there is a vast amount of material there. But you've really got to, you know, make a conscious decision to go and find it. But certainly there will be editorial control as far as the ABC is concerned. I'm quite sure of that. Whether the editorial control is adequate is another question. Whether the editorial control is informed enough to make good decisions about that particular topic. It'll depend on what kind of staff they employ and what kind of background and knowledge they have. But if the the philosophy is getting generalist rather than specialist, that's a problem. Mm.
Mm-hmm. You adverted to this in the way you talked about the division from the classical world to the modern world. Mm. My understanding, since I wasn't there, is that the ancient world sought an educated person who was a synthesizer. A friend of mine used to always talk about academic life as being the unremitting battle between the splitters and the synthesizers. And I think that the splitters have got the upper hand these days. It all goes back to education, doesn't it? Starting with the home and the parents, and then the schools.
Yes, there used to be what was called a classical education, and you know, if you went to Oxford or Cambridge and did a Bachelor of Arts, you know, you were trained to be an educated person to work in virtually any field. But we certainly live in the age of specialisation. If you look at medicine, you know, there's a specialist, take the human eye, there's one that looks after the eyeball, there's somebody else that looks after the muscular tissue around the eye. And actually, Lonergan is very conscious of this, that somehow we have to come up with methods that all the specializations can be brought together, and that there has to be sharing of knowledge as fields of knowledge do split up into specializations. So I think what you say is right, you know, that we need synthesizers, no doubt about that. Yes.
Since you talked about my former profession, I often joke, and this is not a joke really, just as well because it's not very funny, but I often say that we're coming rapidly to the time where we haven't actually reached it, where you come to see a doctor and he says, "I'm sorry, your problem is in your left kidney and I'm a specialist in the right kidney." But in fact, it's very, very true, because journals are finding it harder and harder to get reviewers of papers which they publish, because people are not getting any credit within their institutions for that, but because of this specialisation that's involved, where people don't feel confident that they can make a generalist overview of the particular discipline. And it's a very serious issue, and it has its reflection. Some years ago, Nature published the results of a commercial company who were trying to think of protein remedies that they could use in the revolution from simple chemicals to complex chemicals in their treatments. And they were being very sensible, and they said, "Well, we better not put a lot of money into this in case we've backed the wrong horses. So let's pick some fields which could be commercially attractive and repeat the work ourselves." They could duplicate not even 50% of what was published in the scientific journals. And the same was done in psychology a few years later by a man in Virginia who commissioned people around the world to repeat classical experiments in psychology. And likewise, they couldn't replicate more than even as much as 50% of the research publications and the findings in research journals. That's a reflection, I think, of poor editorial processes, poor refereeing, and it comes back to this specialisation where people do not feel confident that they can have a worldview anymore.
I thoroughly enjoyed your talk, and you wove a very rich tapestry of the four quarters, and coming across the challenges, finding solutions, and extending whichever quarter you were in. Now, if I were to ask you, and I think probably unfairly, because each of those quarters had richness in its own way, which of those four quarters would be at the top of your sense of satisfaction, shall I say? I mean, I know it's an unfair question, because each quarter was a very rich quarter, and whichever quarter you were in, you saw the challenges, you found solution, you extended the parameters of that quarter in a rich way.
Mm.
So if I were to ask you, with hindsight, if you were asked to say, well, relatively speaking, this is something I got the most satisfaction from, or enjoyed or whatever other terms you might consider appropriate.
Mm. So you're referring to the four acts?
Yes, yes. I'm sorry, yes, beg your pardon.
Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yes.
Well, they're a bit artificial, I suppose. Life has been a stream. I think I was very satisfied when I got a job in the ABC, and I enjoyed my time there immensely. And the reason I left was that I began to disagree with the way the place was going and the management style. And I think, you know, in life you come to a decision such as that where you say, well, okay, do I hang on and fight a battle which I think I'm going to lose, or make a change? I found all of the four quarters, I don't know about equally, but certainly satisfying. I was very satisfied with the education that I had. The studies that I did in philosophy and theology proved invaluable. And I was so blessed to be in a place that was progressive. And then, as I said, Vatican II was no surprise to me. The ABC was very satisfying in terms of creativity. It's funny, when preparing this talk, I was thinking of a program that I did. Mary and I were married in 1967, and that year I was acting supervisor of the department in Melbourne. And so we got married and we had to move to Melbourne to live. That lasted for about a year. But while I was there, in the Encounter program, each state would take it in turns to do an Encounter program. They were all scheduled out. As I said, the radio system was pretty watertight. And there was one coming up in Melbourne. I thought, I'll do it myself, because I like to be creative. So, you know, Brahms's variations on a theme. I chose that, which takes about 20 minutes. The Encounter program is 45 minutes long. And in between each variation, I read poetry. And I chose the poems that flowed from the rhythm of one variation into the next one. So if the next one started off with a bang, the poem I put before that was The Windhover by Gerard Manley Hopkins, which ends up with Gash Gold Vermilion, and then bang, the music. So I did that. I got 320 letters for that program. Amazing. That was very satisfying. Alison Healy, in her thesis about the ABC Religion Radio Department, she made that comment. She said that when she said I was a diffident director, the people had been director before me were much more academic, and the one immediately before me was very logical and precise, etc. And I think when I came in, people felt things were a bit slack. But on the other hand, one of the staff, Dagmar Strauss, who was in Melbourne, she said it was wonderful because she felt that she had more freedom to be creative. So it's a kind of a balance. But I was, and doing the Sacred Music program was very satisfying. I mean, I did that for 15 years. I kind of educated myself in the field of music tremendously. And, you know, that always got good audience reaction. So I guess I'd be most satisfied doing creative things. I was less satisfied with the bureaucracy. And the same thing would have applied when I moved into the Catholic education system. Initially, it was very challenging and very fulfilling. But then, of course, you know, the financing and all that stuff tends to step in and ruin it. But there's always been my beautiful wife and my children.
Thanks very much.
How would you respond to the idea that the media thrives on conflict and therefore it's advantageous for it to create conflict?
Yes, that is true in some areas. I was very certainly not inclined that way. And, well, our programs in religion were very rarely, almost never like that. Caroline Jones is an interesting example. I knew Caroline quite well, and we actually went to Tonga once together to do a documentary about religion in Tonga, which that's a story all in, of its own. But I actually said to Caroline once when she was doing Australian Story, I said, I think Australian Story is one of the best religious programs on television because it was so positive, showing people, you know, but there was pathos and sorrow in it as well. But in terms of portraying human life in its beauty and its depth, it was a great program. And, of course, then she went on to do that program called The Search for Meaning. And when I did the research with Hugh McKay about where we should go in television, they were the things that came up. Meaning and people telling stories, anything that was related to that kind of broad spiritual dimension of life, not so much formal religion. And, of course, you know, when I joined the ABC, the religion department was very Christian, very Christian. I mean, just before I joined, there were three church services on radio every Sunday. There was two in the morning and one in the evening. And then when television came in, there was always a church service every Sunday, always Christian, of course. The three programs on radio, the early morning one morphed into a program called Radio Service, which allowed us to produce something in the form of a service but freewheeling, not tied to any church. The one at 11 o'clock was always from a church, and the other one became Encounter, which became a documentary program.
Evensong?
Oh, yes, Evensong.
For the God Who Sings?
Yes, well, that's still going. Yes, this lady mentions The God Who Sings. That's still going, and Stephen Watkins was in the department when I was still there. Evensong, yes. That was broadcast, I don't know, it was every month or it was on a Friday afternoon, and I often went to St Andrew's Cathedral to record it. That's how I got to know Laurie Bartlett and get into the Australian hymn book. There were lots of... but the conflict thing was pretty rare. We tended to be ecumenical, and I had a good relationship with Rabbi Apple, at the synagogue in Elizabeth Street. And we would always broadcast the Jewish High Holy Days. And he used to visit me once a year. He would come to my office just to have a talk kind of thing. And I can still remember the last time we spoke. I would always explain to him how we allocated the programs according percentage of population and all that kind of thing. And as he got up to go, he was very formal. He stopped at the door, he turned around and he said, "Mr. Kirkwood, thank you very much. We've done much better from you than we ever got from the BBC." Because he had come out from England. So I thought, oh, well, that's good. Yes.
You just mentioned your travels to Tonga, and I know that you travelled to other countries as well, like Jamaica, making programs with the ABC. And I wondered, as someone who studied theology and spent a life in, you know, exploring religion and faith in different cultures, how though travelling to those countries and exploring those different faiths within different cultures influenced your career, your sort of choices, your creative choices in your career, and perhaps deepened your own faith?
Yeah. The one in Tonga, I can't remember. It was an anniversary of the arrival of Christianity in Tonga. I don't know, probably 100 years or something. And the Uniting Church in Australia, or it might have been the Methodist Church still, approached us to do a co-production. They wanted a program that commemorated that event, but they didn't want it to be in-house. They wanted outsiders to do it. So we did a co-production, and I went. I had a director called Tony Chen. Caroline Jones came to do the interviewing and all that stuff. And the cameraman was Don McAlpin, who was one of the best in Australia. Tongan culture is pretty well 100% Christian and pretty well 100% from the Methodist tradition. But as you went around and talked to people, and some of them ordinary people, some academics, I remember one fellow saying, Christianity is a thin veneer on Tongan culture. So his opinion was that, what he said, thin veneer, that it really hadn't penetrated. And that's something that became obvious to me. I mean, it's the same thing with our own Indigenous people. The church has not done well in working with other cultures. It's basically been the culture of Europe transplanted. And in cases where, for instance, the Jesuits in Japan or in Western India, the Malabar Rites and that kind of thing, when missionaries did try to meld in with other cultures, the Vatican would quite often come down on them and say, no, you've got to have the Mass in Latin like it is everywhere else. And that was a terrible mistake. So I was certainly conscious of that. Jamaica, I wasn't so conscious of the local cultures there because I went there because there was a meeting of the World Council of Churches, and the president at the time happened to be Philip Potter, who was a Jamaican, so he arranged to have the meeting there to be with his own people. But I did interview a number of people locally, but they were... And Jamaica was pretty well mostly Christian. So there wasn't any evidence of a strong kind of local culture. But, I mean, this is what Lonergan says in his book. He defines theology as a bridge between a culture and a religion. And he says a theology. A theology is a bridge between a religion and a culture. So you can have many theologies. You can have an Australian Jewish theology. You can have a New Zealand Maori theology. You can have an Australian Indigenous theology. And you can have an Australian Muslim. So this word theology is this bridge of how religion interacts with local culture. And it should be allowed to interact much more freely rather than impose something that came from Europe. I mean, it's a mistake that's been made, unfortunately.
We've had several interesting accounts of places like Papua New Guinea, and you've mentioned Tonga. Was at any stage the doctrine of discovery taken into account before these places were visited? Sorry. And I'm sorry, the discovery doctrine ever play any preliminary discussions before wherever you want, like Tonga or East Timor or Papua New Guinea or Solomon Islands or whatever? The doctrine of discovery doctrine and the Pope's original permission for these people to go ahead, there was an assumption that this needed to be spread to civilize them or whatever.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by discovery doctrine, but of course Europeans were notorious for moving into other parts of the world and imposing their values and their culture and their religion. And in areas where they tried to meld with the local culture, they were quite often defeated. I mean, there's that famous film, The Mission, in South America, where the efforts of the church there were ridden over by people that just wanted the money.
Yes. And I think that it was the first, the Pope Alexander, I think there was one, Pope Alexander before the Portuguese and Spanish missions that went out. Mm. And so they felt they had legitimacy, credibility, to do whatever they wanted in the name of God.
Mm.
I mean, you know, there was an assumption that whatever was there wasn't good enough and therefore had to be tamed. They might have had other ulterior motives, for example, to do what they did in Latin America or Hispanic America and other places. And perhaps when you say the Vatican came down heavily, was that in accord with what had originally been Vatican practice?
I think it was European cultural practice.
Okay.
It's only recently that we have begun to understand the spirituality of our Indigenous Australians. And I've said to people recently, I don't like the word God, I like the word the Great Spirit. God, comes to us from European culture, and of course it comes from a language in which there are many gods. But I love that term, the Great Spirit, which it has so many layers of meaning, including living in all of us, living in the whole of creation, living in the land, living in the stones, living in the rocks. And you don't necessarily have to believe that there is a God in every, we've taken such a long time to learn from other people's beliefs and cultures.
Can I just make a comment? I come from Malaysia, and it was not the Vatican that told the missionaries that they couldn't go. It was the government. They were very welcome to come and do whatever they needed to do to help people in any way at all. But Muslims, they were not to try and integrate or infiltrate that religion. I went to a Catholic school in Malacca. The nuns came from France. They looked after the orphans. They did so much. St. Francis Xavier, one of his many graves, is in Malacca. I know there are a couple of other graves in other places too. Missionaries certainly went all the time, but it wasn't because of the Vatican. It was because of the country's government. And it seemed to work very well. And they do believe in God, of course, the Muslims.
Patrick, thanks very much for your talk. If I may make a comment, not specifically about your talk, but about the topic that's just come up. And so far as I'm aware, there's been, this doctrine of discovery has been overstated. So far as I'm aware, it was never a Vatican or papal teaching at all. As was mentioned, Pope Alexander in the 1490s essentially accommodated the Spanish and Portuguese by saying, basically, you get half the globe each. I mean, it was a sort of a practical arrangement. But already in 1537, so only 17 years after Cortes invaded Mexico, the Pope issued the bull Sublimus Deus, recognising the humanity and the openness of native peoples to redemption, and admonishing the European powers not to exploit them and to treat them with respect. So we can't really talk about a doctrine of discovery as such. On a question of enculturation, of course, that's an extremely important area, but a complex one, I think. When we look at some things like the Jesuit acceptance of veneration of ancestors in China, which, of course, the Vatican forbade. That was very likely a Vatican mistake. Whereas in India, for example, the Jesuit Roberto de Nobili argued that the caste system was essentially like class hierarchy in Europe, but in fact it wasn't. It was tied in with Hindu metaphysics, and it wasn't something the church should accept. So enculturation was overstated in that case. So it's quite a complex and differentiated issue.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
Good, thank you.
Thank you so much for a very challenging and intriguing paper. And the quotes from Francis on ageing and whatever. I'd just like to make a quick reference to John O'Brien, Monsignor, the name escapes me.
Hardigan.
Thank you so much, Hardigan. Bill Clements, the sculptor, has created a bas relief on the wall beside the Church of St Mel's, as he has done at Redfern, to maintain the memory of Father Ted Kennedy. And he's also done the full-life study of statue of Mum Shirl there, albeit it took 30-odd years from the time he did the first matrix of it for it to be cast. So I'd just like to make reference to that.
Thank you.
Historical in importance. I know that Bill had a great struggle with the committee that was set up to put it up. If I recall correctly, it was over his inclusion of a small item referring to the poem Laughing Mary.
Thank you. On that theme of Monsignor Hardigan, a final... I left out one story that I had about him. He was a car enthusiast. He went to England. There was a car called the Aluminium Alvis, which was one of the fastest cars in the world at the time. He went to England, actually, to buy one and bring it back to Australia. And he got them to take him onto the famous, is it Brooklands, racing circuit, just to make sure that it went fast enough for him. He brought it back to Australia, and he drove it from Narrandera to Grongrong, which is down the line a bit. It would have been on a dirt road in some extraordinary time. So while we were down there in our ABC Blue station wagon with a bitumen road, we tried it out. We didn't get anywhere near the time that he drove it. He was extraordinary. But anyway, one of his curates that came said, "Father, Father, can I drive your car?" And he said, no, you can't, go away. "Father, Father, I'd like to drive your car." No, go away. And he kept up, "Father, Father, I want to drive your car." "Oh, all right," he said. "Look, it's out there in the garage. I want to go out anyway. You can back it out for me." So he backed it out and backed it out into a pole. And Hardigan was furious. And he said, "If it wasn't Friday, I'd eat you."
Well, I think Patrick has been on his feet for almost 2 hours. And I think that we should let him sit down now. But as I said at the beginning, he's a giant. And you can now see why. Thank you.
You are too kind.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Milk of Paradise, Patrick Kirkwood reflecting on family, church and media in his lifetime from 1935 to the present. Patrick has formerly been head of religious programs, radio and TV at the ABC and director, Catholic Audiovisual Centre, Homebush. The Q&A which followed the talk was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It took place on Sunday, the 21st of May, 2023, in the crypt of the Parish Church of St. Patrick, Churchill, Sydney, Australia. This ACHS talk was recorded by Dr. Julie Thorpe, and the podcast produced by me, John Kenny, on lands whose first custodians were respectively the Gadigal and the Wallumedegal peoples of the Eora Nation. The Society acknowledges the traditional owners of the lands upon which we record and make the podcast and of all places in which our streams may be heard. We hope to be back in a month with another ACHS podcast, and on Sunday the 18th of June our talk at St. Pat's is entitled From Taproot to Rhizome, and it's not about gardening. Dr. Sister Catherine Tom, RSJ, will tell us things we never knew about the distinctive lives of New South Wales Josephites in the years 1968 to 2008. For Sister Catherine, the rhizome, with its branching horizontal rather than top-down root structure, symbolises greater involvement of religious sisters in decision-making and exercising authority. You're welcome to join us then for more history. Bye for now.